The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander and Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the February 12th, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a game table. It's got a map of the world on it with the different colors, and it's, I don't know if you're familiar with this game called Whac-A-Mole. It's got holes in it, and there are little coronavirus balls popping up in different places. And in front of the table is a woman with a mallet in her hand to knock the balls back down. The mallet's got a symbol of a syringe on it. She's got on a lab coat and gloves. She's masked up and has glasses on, protective glasses, looking intently. The headline is Vaccines versus Variants. The coronavirus mutations that have scientists playing whack-a-mole. And that's our first main story. New virus variants raise alarm. What happened? Even as the U.S. saw a continuing steep drop in COVID-19 cases this week, health officials expressed growing concern about the accelerated spread of new coronavirus variants and their resistance to vaccines protection. Maryland and South Carolina reported 5 cases of the South Africa variant, or B1351, which has overwhelmed South Africa and spread to at least 32 countries and appears to be reinfecting people previously sickened with COVID. The B117 strain, or UK variant, which spreads up to 70% more easily than earlier strains and may be 30% more lethal, has been detected in at least 30 states. A case of the P1 strain that has devastated the Brazilian city of Manaus was reported in Minnesota. University of Minnesota epidemiologist Michael Osterholm warned the variants could cause a Category 5 hurricane of new cases in about 6 weeks. "We are going to see something like we have not seen yet in this country," Osterholm said. The warnings came at the same time vaccines have brought hope for an end to the pandemic. Johnson & Johnson unveiled trial data showing it its single-dose vaccine is 66% effective in preventing illness and 100% effective in preventing deaths and hospitalizations. Novavax released preliminary results showing nearly 90% effectiveness in a British trial. But both vaccines showed somewhat reduced effectiveness against the South African variant, as did Pfizer and Moderna's vaccines. "The implications are really worrisome," said Peter Hotez, the dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine. New U.S. infections continue to drop that cut new cases by nearly 40% in recent weeks as the holiday surge waned and new restrictions on indoor gatherings were put in place. Vaccination rates were up in the nation, averaging over 1.3 million shots daily, with Johnson & Johnson soon to apply for emergency authorization and Pfizer promising to deliver 200 million doses by May instead of July. But with many months to go before widespread vaccination is achieved, public health officials beseech the public to triple down on masking, distancing, and other safety measures. "It is a pivotal moment," said virologist Shane Crotty. What the editorial said: "The virus variants demand an urgent response on the federal level," said the Washington Post. "Genetic sequencing technology that can track virus mutations has developed rapidly, but the U.S. is way behind other nations in using it. building a massive cross-country genomic virus surveillance network should be a pressing priority for the Biden administration, so we aren't flying blind into the next storm. As the National rolls up its sleeves, emerging evidence of racial inequality in vaccination should sound warning bells, said the Houston Chronicle. Early data show that Black and Latino Americans, who are three times more likely to die from COVID than whites, are being vaccinated at rates up to three times lower. Fighting this will require outreach campaigns to overcome vaccine hesitancy, locating vaccination sites in poor neighborhoods, and improving labyrinthine registration process that shut out those lacking computer savvy. What the columnist said. The vaccine news is better than many people realize, said David Linhart in the New York Times. All five vaccines with public results have eliminated COVID-19 deaths and drastically cut hospitalizations. The vaccine may work less well against the variants, but still appear to prevent serious illness and death. Vaccines can turn COVID into a manageable illness so children can go back to school and grandparents can nuzzle their grandchildren. Brazil's massive outbreak from a new strain raises the possibility that the coronavirus might be outracing our efforts to contain it, said David Wallace Wells in NYMag.com. It will take up to 3 years to vaccinate a majority of people in the developing world, and as the virus continues to spread and replicate, more mutations will arise. The worst-case scenario is that some will emerge that achieve immune escape, meaning that antibodies from previous COVID cases and vaccines no longer work. President Biden needs to stop blaming the coronavirus catastrophe on Donald Trump and step up, said Robert Zubrin in NationalReview.com. Instead of waiting on Moderna's trickle of new doses, his administration should license that messenger RNA vaccine developed with federal money to every qualified company that can produce it. And the FDA must stop dragging its heels on approving the Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca vaccines, the latter of which has already been given to over 1 million people in the UK. We're caught between the rising hope and looming catastrophe, said Leanna Wynn in the Washington Post. Vaccinations are underway, but the spreading variants could derail school openings and make more lockdowns inevitable. The race is on to beat back the virus with vaccines before the variants overwhelm us, but we know how to win it. If we slow transmission with masking and distancing, we will slow variants. Whether we've passed our darkest hour or calamity lies ahead is up to us. And before we move on, we'll have a It Wasn't All Bad short piece. Oregon healthcare workers were on their way to the town of Grants Pass to administer leftover vaccine shots when a snowstorm stopped them in their tracks. With a precious vial of vaccine in their hands that was set to expire in 6 hours, they knew they wouldn't make it to their destination in time. So workers went car to car asking stranded drivers if they wanted to receive a shot. We had one individual who was so happy, he took off his shirt and jumped out of the car, said Michael Weber, Josephine County's public health director. All six doses found takers. Our number one rule right now is nothing gets wasted. The controversy of the week is titled, Biden, Will His Climate Agenda Make a Difference? A new day for the climate is coming, said Elizabeth Colbert in NewYorker.com. In the first weeks of Joe Biden's presidency, a critical threshold has been crossed in the fight against climate change. Biden immediately signed a raft of executive orders recommitting the U.S. to the Paris Climate Accords, canceling the controversial Keystone XL pipeline, and pledging a clean energy revolution that will bring the U.S. to 100% carbon-free electricity by 2035, and net zero carbon emissions by 2050. He followed this with a second, even more sweeping batch of orders that halted the selling of new leases for oil and gas production on federal lands, created a conservation jobs program, the Civilian Climate Corps, and instructed federal agencies to make the shift to zero emissions vehicles. Biden campaigned on a promise to make climate action a priority, said Justin Rowlott in BBC.com. But he stopped short of endorsing the Green New Deal championed by progressives such as Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. But AOC said she was extraordinarily encouraged by the scale and speed of Biden's climate agenda, which has impressed even the nation's deepest green activists. Biden has already achieved his primary climate goal, said WashingtonExaminer.com in an editorial, to signal virtue to the rest of the world and burnish the new administration's un-Trumpy credentials. This rebranding exercise will force consumers to pay higher energy costs, and by canceling Keystone XL, Biden eliminated 1,000 U.S. jobs with just a stroke of his pen. More fossil fuel jobs will be lost over time. Meanwhile, despite its empty promises, China continues to bring dirty new coal plants online. Biden's climate policies are a gift to China. Rather than pander to costly climate alarmism, said Bjorn Lomborg in NYPost.com, Biden should invest billions in green energy research and development to achieve a technological breakthrough. When renewables are cheaper and as efficient as fossil fuels, everyone would switch voluntarily. Executive orders can get Biden only so far, said Spencer Bocott Lindell in the New York Times. To effect lasting change, we need new laws, but getting buy-in from Congress is likely to be extremely difficult. With the filibuster still in place, new legislation will need 10 Republican Senate votes, not to mention the vote of West Virginia Democrat Senator Joe Manchin, who in a 2010 campaign ad literally shot the last major climate bill with a rifle. If Biden wants new laws, he could try to build consensus, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. Instead, he seems determined to handle climate change the way Democrats tackle all problems, by ramming through massive spending schemes without bipartisan support. The politics of climate are changing, said Henry Olson in the Washington Post. Americans are witnessing and experiencing prolonged droughts and heat waves, rampaging wildfires, more damaging hurricanes, persistent coastal flooding, and extreme weather of all kinds, just as climate scientists predicted. This is becoming an issue that the right cannot ignore. Biden's executive orders won't by themselves make greenhouse gases go away, said Eugene Robinson, also in the Post, but they're a clear statement of intent. Biden believes that breakthroughs in green technology should happen here in America, and that the jobs from those advances should go to U.S. workers. Republicans will resist, if only for resistance's sake, but history is on Biden's side, and history, eventually, always wins. It was a good week for making amends after former QAnon adherent Jitarth Jadeja told CNN's Anderson Cooper he'd really believed that Cooper was among the liberal elites who routinely murder children and drink their blood. I apologize for thinking that you ate babies, Jadeja said. It was a good week for Brave New Worlds, with Elon Musk's announcement that scientists at his Neuralink startup have successfully given a monkey a wireless brain implant that lets it play video games by the sheer power of thought. He looks totally happy, said Musk. It was a good week for Stopping the Steal, after election officials in Georgia said they were investigating Lynn Wood, President Trump's colorful election fraud lawyer, for allegedly voting in Georgia after he had moved to South Carolina. It was a bad week for maturity, following the arrest of six people who altered the iconic Hollywood sign above Los Angeles to read Holly Boob. The group claims to have been raising awareness of breast cancer, but as police Captain Steve Lurie put it, This was way uncool. It was a bad week for Grape Nuts fans, as a national shortage of the iconic breakfast cereal sent online prices soaring to $15 a box. Grape Nuts is made using a proprietary technology, the company said, which has made it more difficult to shift production to meet demand. Finally, it was a bad week for marketing after federal investigators charged Troy Faulkner, 39, with two felonies when videos circulating on YouTube showed him breaking into the Capitol wearing a jacket emblazoned with his company's name and phone number. "I was upset and wasn't thinking rationally," Faulkner explained. Our briefing page article is titled, "The White Supremacist Threat." In the wake of the January 6th insurrection, federal officials are warning of more attacks by violent domestic extremists. What are the extremists' goals? Far-right extremism encompasses a broad number of groups whose specific beliefs and goals vary. They fall into two broad overlapping categories: white supremacist groups who believe they must defend the white race from extinction, and anti-government paramilitary groups or militias who see themselves as revolutionary heroes opposing a tyrannical federal government and the New World Order, a secretive global government run by Jews and socialists. Some militias are dedicated to the violent overthrow of the U.S. government. Some accelerationists, such as the Boogaloo Boys, aim to spark a civil war between the races to establish the U.S. as a white Christian ethnostate. The violent attack on the Capitol, law enforcement officials say, was spearheaded by these groups, all of which, says Kathleen Ballou, a University of Chicago historian who studies white supremacists, are fundamentally opposed to the exercise of American democracy. When did the militia movement begin? While armed anti-government groups are a longtime presence in the U.S., the modern militia movement dates to the 1980s. It grew in response to the election of President Bill Clinton in 1992 and the subsequent passage of gun restrictions, including the assault weapons ban in 1994, which alarmed those who see all gun restrictions as a form of tyranny. Two incidents in this era galvanized the movement. The first was a 1992 standoff in Ruby Ridge, Idaho, where federal agents executing a warrant on a white supremacist killed his wife and son in a shootout. Then in 1993, a federal siege on the Branch Davidians compound in Waco, Texas, led to a firefight and a fire that caused the deaths of 82 members of the religious sect. In 1995, Timothy McVeigh, an Army veteran with ties to militia and white supremacist groups, detonated a massive truck bomb that destroyed a federal building in Oklahoma City, killing 168 people and injuring more than 680. After the national revulsion over that attack, militia activity dropped significantly, but it came back with a vengeance in 2008. What happened in 2008? The election of the country's first black president, Barack Obama, which horrified far-right extremists. Experts say the 2008 economic collapse deepened their fears and cynicism, while Facebook and other social media facilitated recruitment efforts. Two of the most prominent anti-government groups emerged around this time: the Oath Keepers, a militia focused on rallying former military and police to honor their oath against tyranny, and the Three Percenters, whose name refers to the supposed percentage of Americans who took up arms against tyrannical British rule during the Revolutionary War. In 2009, the Department of Homeland Security issued a report warning of a dangerous surge in right-wing extremism, which was withdrawn after conservatives charged that the Obama administration was trying to criminalize and suppress dissent. How many people are involved? Experts estimate there are now tens of thousands of far-right extremists connected to several hundred groups. The Southern Poverty Law Center identified 576 extreme anti-government groups in 2019, 181 of them militias. The group counted 155 white nationalist hate groups the same year, a 55% increase over 2017. But experts caution that such groups' influence extends far beyond the people who identify themselves as members. Just as ISIS's online propaganda spawned lone wolf attacks, law enforcement officials say white supremacist rhetoric helped inspire Patrick Crucius, 22, to open fire on Hispanics at a Walmart in El Paso, Texas, killing 23, and Dylan Roof, 26, who murdered 9 black parishioners in a church in Charleston, South Carolina. Why is the threat growing? A major factor, experts who study white supremacists say, is the election and rhetoric of Donald Trump. His outspoken anti-immigrant stance in defense of the white supremacist who marched in Charlottesville in 2017 electrified extremist groups who believed the president of the U.S. was signaling his approval. With Trump, the fringe entered the mainstream, said Lawrence Rosenthal of the Center for Right-Wing Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Militias were further mobilized by government restrictions in response to the pandemic, which they see as tyrannical overreach, and the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement. White supremacist and militia members clashed with BLM demonstrators across the country last summer and protested pandemic restrictions at many state capitals. In Michigan, 14 militia members were charged with developing an advanced plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer and try her for treason. Following the January 6th Capitol insurrection, authorities found strong evidence that militias played a central role in organizing and directing the attack. What's being done? President Biden vowed in his inaugural address to confront a rise in political extremism, white supremacy, and domestic terrorism. He's ordered the Director of National Intelligence to work with the FBI and DHS to compile a comprehensive assessment. But even as that assessment begins, experts warn that the Capitol attack and the Democrats' return to power have further energized far-right extremists, and that a long and fraught conflict lies ahead. Lindsay Schubiner, a program director at the Western States Center who studies white nationalism, said, "This isn't something that can be put back in the bottle." We'll move into some of the best columns of the week, starting with Biden's China problem. President Biden's biggest foreign policy nightmare may be China, said Nicholas Kristof. In coming years, there is a significant risk of a military confrontation with the world's most populous nation because President Xi Jinping is an overconfident, risk-taking bully who believes that the United States is in decline. Xi has been sending threatening signals about invading Taiwan, whose independence he finds galling. As a test, he could order China's military to seize the Pratas and Kinmen Islands, now controlled by Taiwan, or a cyber attack on Taiwan's banking system, or blockade of its oil deliveries. That kind of aggression could draw the U.S. into perhaps the most dangerous confrontation with another nuclear power since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Even if Xi does not go that far, Biden has to contend with China's oppression of Hong Kong, It's genocide of the Uyghurs, it's contempt for human rights, and it's unfair trade practices. Biden has recruited a tough-minded team of Asia experts who understand that China is an untrustworthy adversary, but a China policy that is too confrontational could lead to a dangerous escalation of tensions. Let's keep the Cold War with Beijing cold. The rise of Christian nationalism. When a violent mob broke into the Senate chamber on January 6, said Rachel Mikva, one of the leaders cried out, "Jesus Christ, we invoke your name." It was a vivid demonstration of the problem Christian nationalism poses to this country. An estimated 20% of American adults, most of them white, believe the U.S. should be expressly Christian country, with biblical teachings guiding every aspect of civic life. Furious and frightened about losing culture war battles over abortion rights, LGBTQ equality, and gender norms, Christian nationalists have declared a holy war, drawing apocalyptic language from the Book of Revelation about a cosmic battle between good and evil. At the Capitol riot, insurrectionists carried large wooden crosses, Bibles, and Jesus flags. Some organizers called the attack the Jericho March, alluding to the Israelites' raid on the city of Jericho. Christian nationalists are also working within the system to install judges who will cite religious freedom to impose their worldview on the law. Senator Josh Hawley, the Republican from Missouri, has said his mission is to transform our society to reflect the gospel truth and lordship of Jesus Christ. What if you don't agree? To Hawley and other Christian nationalists, then you're not a real American. And rather than reading a third column, I'm going to read a technology article for you. Space, the final broadband frontier. Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos are battling for space supremacy, said Joey Roulette in TheVerge.com. And it's not about their dueling rocket companies, SpaceX and Blue Origin. The world's two richest men are also racing to build vast networks of satellites in low Earth orbit capable of bringing high-speed broadband internet around the globe. SpaceX, Musk's interstellar transport venture, already has 955 satellites in orbit for its Starlink network and plans to launch thousands more. But when SpaceX asked regulators for permission to lower the planned altitudes for its satellites, Amazon objected, claiming that would interfere with its own broadband satellite effort, Project Kuiper. The feud spilled out into the open last week when Musk complained on Twitter that the FCC was trying to hamstring Starlink in favor of an Amazon system that was at best several years away. Starlink is quickly generating the same viral appeal as Tesla, said Dana Hill, Hull, and Bloomberg.com. And it's not just Amazon that has cause to worry. Facebook groups, Reddit threads, and Twitter are filled with reports from early customers sharing images of their download speeds, and YouTube has videos of people unboxing their Starlink satellite dish. SpaceX is focusing on bringing broadband to over 10 million Americans in rural areas. But as it sends up more satellites, the coverage area will grow, and telecom could turn into Elon Musk's next disruption. The early results have been encouraging. It's a game changer, said Brian Rendell, a Starlink tester in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, who is now getting speeds of 100 megabytes per second for downloads and 15 to 20 for uploads, far faster than his previous internet provider. Satellites are clearly beating balloons in the race for flying internet, said Zoe Kleinman in BBC.com. Google gave up on Loon, its effort to beam the internet down to rural areas via a network of helium balloons. And Facebook abandoned a drone-based internet project, Aquila, in 2018. Once considered the slowest, most expensive option for broadband providers, satellites are now smaller and cheaper. But affordability remains a challenge. Starlink service currently costs $99 a month, plus $4.99 for the equipment. Stargazers are also upset about the crowding of the night sky, said Lucy Green in Wired.co.uk. In addition to worries about orbital collisions between satellites and space debris, astronomers are complaining of seeing their images photobombed by satellites. SpaceX is adding sunshades to reduce the object's brightness, but Musk has downplayed the concerns. There are already 4,900 satellites in orbit, he tweeted last year, which people notice approximately 0% of the time. Time for our in-depth article, The Last Word. Titled this week, The Most Powerful Senator. Senator Joe Manchin is a moderate Democrat from coal country, said Sarah Kaplan and Dino Grandoni in The Washington Post. He may decide the fate of the Biden administration's ambitious climate plan. He's a coal country native born to a family of mining town mayors. As West Virginia governor, he sued the Environmental Protection Agency. He has scuttled efforts to regulate greenhouse gas emissions, criticized the Paris Climate Agreement, and famously shot a copy of a cap-and-trade carbon proposal full of lead. Now the fate of the most ambitious climate agenda ever proposed by an American president rests in his hands. Senator Joe Manchin III, the incoming chairman of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, is a conservative Democrat from one of the reddest states in the country. In a Senate split 50-50, Manchin is also a critical swing vote on contentious legislation, defining the limits of what President Biden and the Democrats can accomplish. Last week, he led a bipartisan, bicameral group of lawmakers in talks with the White House over its proposed $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package. But perhaps few of Biden's priorities will be as polarizing as the environment. The president ran on a $2 trillion plan to transition the U.S. economy toward renewable energy sources and cut the planet-warming pollution that comes from oil, gas, and coal. Biden has framed his proposal as a jobs plan, but the fossil fuel industry, including coal companies, warns of fallout, lost jobs and tax revenue, and higher consumer cost. Manchin has already said he doesn't support eliminating the filibuster as a way to enable Democrats to pass bills without Republican votes. If Democrats are to fight climate change, he wants them to do it the old-fashioned way, his way. That means deals forged through compromise, the gears of government greased by long-standing relationships, and the occasional mason jar of moonshine served during negotiations. I want to work with them and hear all different sides of it, from the environmental to the industrial base, Manchin said in a recent interview. But the physics of greenhouse gases accumulating in the atmosphere are non-negotiable. Scientists say nations need to dramatically cut emissions to avoid catastrophic warming that would come with its own economic toll. Devastating fires and floods, water scarcity, displacement, disease, and death. It remains to be seen whether a moderate like Manchin can help bring about the change the planet demands. In a bitterly divided Washington, Joe Manchin is a rare breed. A habitual aisle crosser, he maintains strong friendships with Republican colleagues like Senator Lisa Murkowski, the Republican from Alaska, the Energy Committee's outgoing chair. He attacked Barack Obama's environmental policies and voted to confirm more of Donald Trump's cabinet appointees than any other Democrat. He claims to hate everything about Washington, sleeping on a houseboat named Almost Heaven rather than getting an apartment in the city. But in 2018, when Manchin announced he was fed up with the Senate, party leaders talked him into running for another term, figuring he was probably the only Democrat in West Virginia who would win. Manchin, 73, is a native son who made good. Star student in the small mining town of Farmington. Promising quarterback for the West Virginia University Mountaineers until a knee injury ended his career. Successful businessman who oversaw a coal brokerage before running for public office. His political star rose even more as the state grew more conservative. In 2004, the same year West Virginia voted for Republican President George W. Bush by a 13-point margin, Manchin was handily elected governor. He impressed constituents by pushing through new safety regulations in 24 hours after a mining disaster killed 14 people. "What's in it for West Virginia," is Manchin's guiding principle, former staffers say. The Paris Climate Agreement wasn't good for the roughly 20,000 West Virginians who work in coal, oil, and gas, he said. He argued that Obama's clean power plan would make electricity for his constituents less affordable. Manchin also maintained a vested interest in his state's fossil fuel industry. His most recent financial disclosures show that he holds stocks worth between $1 and $5 million in Inner Systems, the coal brokerage firm he used to run. Fellow Democratic senators are understanding of his predicament. When Manchin talks with Senator Brian Schatz, the Democrat from Hawaii, he draws an analogy between tourism in Hawaii and coal in West Virginia. He said, "Well, what would happen if someone came into your state and said your number one industry is the problem?" According to Schatz, that doesn't mean liberals haven't tried to persuade him. In 2014, Manchin and Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, the Democrat from Rhode Island, arranged a cultural exchange. Manchin boarded a trawler on the Rhode Island Sound so fishermen could tell the coal state senator about how climate change had affected their livelihoods. "I remember the captain of the trawler that we went out on saying to us, 'Senator, this is not my father's ocean any longer. Things are getting weird out there,'" Whitehouse said. In turn, Whitehouse, who, like Schatz, is one of the most outspoken senators on climate change, took a trip to coal country, saying afterward that he had learned to see miners as energy veterans who needed to be considered in any climate legislation. Some of Manchin's stances have changed in parallel with the coal industry's declining fortunes and climate change's rising toll. The same man who once sued the EPA over restrictions on mountaintop removal mining eventually asked federal officials to study the environmental harm from the practice, saying, "I think the method has exceeded its useful life." In 2018, when Manchin was made ranking Democrat on the Senate committee that oversees energy resources and development, nuclear waste policy, and public lands, many environmentalists were outraged at the elevation of an outspoken advocate for fossil fuels. "He simply can't be trusted to make the bold, progressive decisions we need on the Energy Committee," said Washington Governor Jay Inslee, who ran unsuccessfully last year for the Democratic presidential nomination on a climate platform. But working with Murkowski, Manchin pushed the biggest conservation legislation in a decade through a sharply divided Congress, helped fully finance the Land and Water Conservation Fund for the first time in a half century, and made sure the latest coronavirus stimulus bill included billions for solar, wind, and battery storage. Manchin's environmental score, as kept by the League of Conservation Voters, jumped from a low of 20% in 2014 to a high of 86% in 2019. "Folks are always trying to figure out his evolution. Did he change because of this or that?" said Colin O'Mara, chief executive of the National Wildlife Federation and a friend of Manchin's. "But the explanation is not so much a change of heart as a change of circumstances," O'Mara said. "In light of the declining demand for coal, a consequence of shifting markets more than government regulation, Manchin sees clean energy investments as a chance to create new jobs. Everything he's done throughout his career is to make sure there's some level of economic opportunity back home," O'Mara said. "If you understand that about him, everything else makes sense." When the Democrats clinched control of the Senate with a pair of Georgia victories on January 6, Manchin became not just the top lawmaker on energy, but one of the most powerful people in Washington. Even laws approved through budget reconciliation, a process that requires a simple majority for passage, will rely on his support. What a golden opportunity to get compromise back, Manchin recalled thinking that morning. After 4 years of Trump playing to his base and that's about it, he said in a recent interview, I think it's great to see Democrats get to set the agenda and see if they can make this place work. Mere hours later, he found himself in the bowels of the Capitol, sheltering from rioters incited by Trump and some of Manchin's own Republican colleagues. While the mob raged, Manchin tried to reason with GOP senators who planned to object to the Electoral College votes. At least two he lobbied, Senators Steve Daines of Montana and James Lankford of Oklahoma, stood down. But in the end, eight returned to the chamber they'd fled and still voted to dispute the results. That incident undeniably pushed the parties further apart, Manchin acknowledges. Now, to have any hope of passing something as contentious and comprehensive climate legislation, some environmental activists argue that Democrats must be willing to bypass Republican objections by eliminating the filibuster, a tactic that blocks consideration of legislation unless 60 senators agree to end debate and move to a vote. The scientists have told us that we have a handful of years, if not no time at all, to completely transform our society, said Garrett Blad, a spokesman for the Sunrise Movement, a climate crisis advocacy group. He called it naive to think that such a plan would receive support from at least 10 Republicans, the minimum needed to join with 50 Democrats to pass legislation. But if any Democrat could find common ground with the GOP, it's Manchin, said West Virginia Rivers Coalition Executive Director Angie Rosser. She pointed to the success of the bipartisan energy package included in last month's stimulus bill, which one Green group heralded as perhaps the most significant climate legislation Congress has ever passed. Manchin is saying little about how he will manage the Energy Committee as chairman, besides making sure that there's a balance between the environment and the economy, and that no heavy lifting areas in this country are left behind. To that end, any major climate proposal with a chance of getting Manchin's vote will in some ways include carbon capture technology to absorb carbon dioxide before it exits smokestacks. That's not only a way to allow coal and gas-fired power plants to keep operating in a zero-emissions world, but also a boon for West Virginia, which hosts an Energy Department lab in Morgantown that is a center for carbon capture research. Rosser gives Manchin credit for acknowledging that the energy economy is changing, while other West Virginia politicians still promise to bring coal back. One of the reasons I'm excited about him being in this key position, she said, is that West Virginia needs someone who can lead on federal policy in a way that doesn't leave us out. At the same time, fossil fuel groups still see him as a potential ally. I think Senator Manchin is somebody that our industry can work with, said Frank Macciarola, Senior Vice President for Policy at the American Petroleum Institute. Hailing from a state that's rich in coal and natural gas resources, he's someone who recognized those are an important part of the mix as well. The biggest piece of Biden's climate plan that required congressional approval is a set of requirements for power plants to eliminate their contributions to climate change by 2035. Ever mindful of Capitol Hill dynamics, the former senator from Delaware made sure coal and gas-fired power plants could continue to operate as long as they captured the carbon they emitted. Even so, Manchin is leery about setting a standard for power companies that depends on technology that isn't yet cheap or effective enough. Manchin is also wary of the Paris Accord, which Biden moved to rejoin on his first day in office. The senator echoes Republican critiques that the international agreement, designed to keep global temperature increase well below 2 degrees Celsius, demands too little of developing nations. Still, climate change can't be ignored, even in coal country. Constituents in West Virginia are noticing the more frequent floods linked to increased precipitation, Manchin noted. There's nobody I know in my state that wants to drink dirty water, to breathe dirty air, I can assure you, he said. I'm as environmental as anyone else. I'm pretty rational, practical about it, too. This article originally appeared in the Washington Post. Read one of the obituaries for you this week. The screen and stage star who shattered racial stereotypes. Cicely Tyson, 1924 to 2021. Cicely Tyson blazed a trail on stage and screen by demanding that African Americans be portrayed with dignity. After playing prostitutes in two acclaimed off-Broadway plays in the early 1960s, Tyson decided she would never again take a job in which she was cast as a stereotypical black hooker, maid, or addict. Her insistence that a character possesses strength, grace, and depth meant Tyson sometimes went years without work. Even following her Oscar-nominated performance as a Louisiana sharecropper's wife in 1972's Sounder. Yet her uncompromising selectivity paid off, and Tyson delivered a string of electrifying portrayals of resilient black women, both real and fictional, in a seven-decade career. She was a former slave in the 1974 CBS special The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, Kunta Kinte's mother in the blockbuster 1977 TV miniseries Roots, and civil rights activist Coretta Scott King in the 1978 TV biopic King. It amuses me when people say, "Oh my God, you've done so much," she said of her work. "It isn't that I've done so much, it's that what I have done has made a real impact." Tyson was born in Harlem to West Indian immigrants who scraped by in menial jobs, said the Washington Post. Her parents divorced when Tyson was 11, and she was raised by her deeply religious mother. After graduating from high school, the regal and willowy Tyson was set up with a modeling gig by her hairdresser, which led to appearances in Vogue, Harper's Bazaar, and Ebony. She studied at the Actors Studio and landed small parts on TV. Her disapproving mother, who considered show business sinful, stopped talking to her for 2 years. In 1961, she appeared in a hit off-Broadway production of Jean Genet's anti-colonial play, The Blacks, and 2 years later was cast as a secretary in East Side, West Side, a CBS show about social workers. The show was short-lived, but it allowed her to make her mark as the first black actress with a continuing role in a dramatic series and as the trendsetter for her natural, unstraightened hairstyle. Ebony would later hail Tyson as the mother of the Afro. In 1972, Tyson finally landed a leading role with dignity, said the New York Times. Her powerful, understated performance in Sounder, as a woman who holds her family together amid the Great Depression, won rave reviews and an Oscar nomination for Best Actress. For 1974's acclaimed Jane Pittman, she transformed into a 110-year-old ex-slave who lives to see the civil rights movement. In private, Tyson was fiercely disciplined, said the Daily Telegraph. A teetotaling vegetarian, she married Miles Davis in 1981 and helped the jazz legend overcome his drug and alcohol addictions. But the trumpeter's repeat infidelities led to violent rows, one in which he admitted he had punched her, and the couple divorced in 1988. In later life, Tyson continued to choose her projects carefully, said the Times. She won her third Emmy in 1994 for the miniseries Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All, had recurring parts in TV dramas How to Get Away with Murder and House of Cards, and at 88 became the oldest person to win a Tony Award for 2013's The Trip to Bountiful. Retirement was never an option. God, she said, would take her when she had completed my job. And we'll go on over to the Talking Points page with an article titled, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Will the GOP Be Defined by Kooks? The GOP's Marjorie Taylor Greene problem is spinning out of control, said Aaron Blake in the Washington Post. More than 60 House Democrats backed a resolution last week demanding the newly elected Georgia Congresswoman's ouster from the House after social media posts emerged from 2018 and 19 in which she called for executing Democrats and FBI agents and claimed that California wildfires were ignited by a space laser controlled by Jewish bankers. On one Facebook post, Green liked a comment advocating a bullet to the head for Democratic House Leader Nancy Pelosi. In a 40-minute YouTube video from 2018, she questioned whether a plane had actually crashed into the Pentagon on 9/11 and accused the Clintons of sabotaging John F. Kennedy Jr.'s doomed airplane to keep him from competing with Hillary for a U.S. Senate seat. In another video, she is seen hounding Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School shooting survivor David Hogg outside the Capitol building, calling him a coward and alleging that his support for gun control was funded by billionaire George Soros. In other posts, she expressed support for QAnon, said the stage is set for executing Hillary and Barack Obama, and claimed that the Sandy Hook Elementary School and Las Vegas mass shootings were false flag operations created by liberals to promote gun control. When confronted with her statements, said Chris Saliza in CNN.com, Green remained defiant, saying that Democrats are coming after her because I'm a threat to their goal of socialism. But even Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell expressed his disgust. Loony lies and conspiracy theories are a cancer for the Republican Party and our country, McConnell said. McConnell's diagnosis comes a little late, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. Since Donald Trump captured the GOP nomination in 2016, he and other mainstream Republicans did not lift a finger to stop the takeover of their party by the lunatic fringe. They tut-tutted Trump's blatantly racist messages, his irrationality and authoritarianism, and his extraordinary attempt to get Ukraine to announce an investigation of the Bidens. Now they say that while it's regrettable Trump incited a violent attack on the Capitol, it's too late to impeach and convict an ex-president. By constantly giving Trump a pass for his behavior, Republicans open the door to Green's kookiness, which appeals to a sizable segment of their Trumpified Fox News base. Now the GOP is facing a brewing civil war, said Melanie Zanona and Sarah Ferris in Politico.com. Even as Republicans wrestle over how to confront the Green crisis, a group of hardline conservatives is trying to oust Representative Liz Cheney as the House's number three Republican in retaliation for her vote to impeach Trump after the Capitol riot. How the GOP decides to deal with Green and Cheney could reveal the extent to which the GOP remains loyal to Trump, said Eric Lutz. Should Republicans punish Cheney for her heresy while allowing Green to get off with a slap on the wrist? It'll be clear that Trump still owns the party's soul. Sadly, Republicans seem more interested in pledging fealty to Trump than in winning elections, said Zachary Faria in WashingtonExaminer.com. Since his narrow upset win in 2016, the former president has been a net detriment to the party's electoral fortunes. Republicans lost 41 House seats in the 2018 midterms and control of the Senate and the White House in 2020. If Green and Trump remain in the face of the party, the GOP can forget winning back control of Congress in 2022 and the White House in 2024. Tell that to House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, said A.B. Stoddard. McCarthy scurried down to Mar-a-Lago last week to beg Trump's forgiveness for blaming him for the Capitol riot and to proclaim him the past, present, and future of the party. After their meeting, the lick-spittle McCarthy shamelessly tweeted that he and the former president were united and ready to win in 2022. Under pressure to at least strip Green of a committee assignment, McCarthy has promised only to have a conversation with her, said Mark Cupato in Politico.com. He knows that Green represents an energetic wing of the party and one he feels he can scarcely afford to risk alienating. What a pity, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post. After Trump's electoral eviction, Republicans had a chance for redemption and resurrection. But instead of repudiating the dumbing down of conservatism, the GOP has surrendered to the demagogues and the crazies. The Republican Party we once knew isn't doomed. It's dead. Here's a poll watch piece as we finish up. Americans feel safer about getting vaccinated, with 66% expressing willingness to get a shot, up from 51% in October. And we'll finish the show out today with a quote from actress Tallulah Bankhead, quoted in Forbes.com. She says, "If I had to live my life again, I'd make the same mistakes, only sooner." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.